Today on the Best of Flashpoints, we'll hear a disturbing eyewitness account of last week's border killing. Also, we'll speak with Jordan Flaherty about the cultural destruction of the Gulf and New Orleans by large corporations, especially BP. And we'll speak with FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley about the importance of speaking truth to power in our tightly controlled society. In Berkeley, I'm Jesse Strauss with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In San Francisco, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We go back to the story of the shooting last Monday. That was June 7th, in which a 14-year-old was shot in the head and killed by a Border Patrol agent at the El Paso connection with Juarez, a bridge that sees a lot of activity over the Rio Grande River as people come back and forth to live their lives either through the fence or over the bridge. Joining us is Bobbi McDowell. She was an eyewitness to the shooting last Monday. And Ms. McDowell, it is good to have you with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. First of all, maybe you can set the scene. Where were you on the bridge as this scene began to unfold?
Yes, I was headed into Mexico. I was walking up the Santa Fe International Bridge, and I had stopped at the top of the bridge because it was quite hot, and my husband was waiting there for me, and I said, let's rest here for a second. And when I was there looking towards the west, I looked down, and there was a group of teenagers below me. They were on the cement apron of the Rio Grande River, and I said to my husband, oh, let's watch them, because I knew that they were getting ready to cross over.
And so as you watched, what did you see from your vantage point in the middle of the bridge? What exactly did you see happening?
Well, there was approximately six young men, and it looked to me there was four of them that went through the fence at the apron, and two of them stayed behind. I think that they were perhaps the coaches. Four of them proceeded onto the gravel road that runs adjacent to the river, and they headed west, and then they turned a little to the north and went across another fence. And a little further down, there was one more fence that they crossed over, and then they were into the city of El Paso, into, I think it's Chihuahua Street. And just as they dropped into the street there, it's a dead end, one of the Border Patrol agents was alerted, I don't know by who, and he had driven into that street, which is a dead end, and was blocking them. So they started immediately retracing their path. They started hopping the fence, running back, hopping the next fence. One of them stumbled after the second fence, and I think he stumbled twice. And at that point, they were coming back towards the third and final fence to go back through to get on the cement apron. And one of them was
on their way back to Mexico.
Yes, they were clearly on their way back to Mexico.
A few feet away from Mexico.
Yes, they were clearly retreating. One of them was apprehended by the Border Patrol on the gravel road right next to the river, but there's a fence there. And then at that point, they started crawling back through the hole in the fence that they had originally gone through. And the people that were coaching them were there. And then I saw one of the Border Patrol agents on the bicycle riding from the west, riding east, and he was by himself. And at that point, he apprehended one of the young men coming out down from the fence, and the rest of them appeared to go into the riverbed. But there was a few that seemed to be, at least one of them was due west of the Border Patrol agent.
And the agent had his gun drawn. Describe the situation. You called it sort of a precarious situation, the way in which the Border Patrol agent sort of had one kid by the neck or the collar and he was wielding the gun. Could you describe what that looked like and why that made you nervous?
Well, he did grab a hold of the one young man, and at the same time he had his weapon drawn, and it seemed like he had his hands full. He has a person in his hand, left hand, that's not actually handcuffed, and he has his weapon in his right hand, and I thought that it was very dicey that he had both of those things going on at the same time, that it seemed like it could go bad.
And then what happened?
Well, I did see someone to the west. I believe they had a white shirt on, and I do remember them making a motion as if they were throwing something. I didn't see anything, but, you know, I was up on the bridge. The bridge is up pretty high, and I saw no motion by the Border Patrol agent as if he had been hit by anything. And then at that point, it seemed like I was kind of concerned about the situation, but then when he started firing his weapon towards Mexico, I became really, really concerned, and I was still watching him trying to contain the person in his other hand, and he's firing. Then the firing stopped. I think there was four or five shots, but I don't know for sure. There was a lot of echoing because of the cement around the bridge. And then after the firing stopped, I looked to the left, and I couldn't see right away because there's a shadow because of the sun, sun's distance. I saw that there was a body lying there, and then I became really upset that actually there was someone, and the body wasn't moving.
Now that, go on.
I did ask my husband, I said, is that a body there? And he said, yes.
And your husband saw all of this as well?
Yes, he was standing right next to me. We were both right next to each other.
And when you talked about it, after you both essentially saw the same thing, did you see apparently the body that was lying there was that of the 14-year-old junior high school student from Juarez. Mm-hmm. Did you see him throwing any stones?
I did not, but I have to tell you that I couldn't keep my eyes on everyone because people were scattering. I was concentrating mainly on the Border Patrol agent because he's the one with the weapon, and he also had another person in his hand, and I thought that was a very, like I said, precarious situation. But I do recall that there were people that moved to the south across the riverbed, but I couldn't keep my eyes on everyone at the same time.
Living there at the border, living either on one side or the other, people are going back and forth all the time. I'm thinking, and friends of mine who work at the border think, this isn't, if you're a hardened smuggler, you're not going to be coming in through a fence under the international bridge, right?
You wouldn't think so, but, you know, I'm not familiar with exactly what they're doing down there. I can only tell you that I've observed on many occasions the exact same situation happening. That's why I said to my husband, let's watch, because it's basically they see if they can get across. And usually they never make it. The Border Patrol are right there, and they come and get them. But I have never seen this situation escalate where a Border Patrol agent came down into the riverbank and grabbed a hold of one of the persons that had been crossing over illegally and then pulled his weapon and started firing. This was a completely new situation.
Obviously, this was not a pleasant experience for you, seeing a young man killed before your eyes. What do you think is important to know about this incident? What details would you like to tell the public that perhaps aren't getting out in your local paper or around the country?
Well, I feel as if there's a very anti-Mexican mentality, and I'm not sure why, because Mexico's our neighbor, and they're a helpful neighbor. They provide a lot of the products that we buy every day, and, you know, they're people. And I don't agree with what those young men did necessarily, but I don't believe that they should be made out to be less than human.
What kind of investigation would you like to see? How would you like to see this investigated so that it doesn't happen again?
Well, I would like to see more restraint on the side of the officer. As I said, once they started going through the fence and they were clearly within, a few feet of the Mexican border, let them go. I'm not sure what the point of having that confrontation was. I mean, they were clearly on their way back, and if they were juveniles and they were apprehended, they would just be released back anyway, so I'm not sure what that was all about. But I would like to know if there are any other videos so we can get a clear perspective. Unfortunately, the cell phone video isn't quite clear about the persons that were south of the border and what was going on there, and I would absolutely like to know what was happening. I would like to know everything.
And I guess we would know a lot less if there wasn't a cell phone video. I mean, your eyewitness account would have been matched up against, I guess, the Border Patrol and the
Yes.
FBI, who immediately adopted the Border Patrol story, and Fox News. So it would have been your word, Bobby McDowell, against Fox News, the FBI, and the Border Patrol. You probably would have lost.
I would have, but I'm grateful that someone did have the mind to go ahead and take that video. It's very difficult to video because there's fence all along that bridge, and so you have to fit your camera through the little holes in the wire. But I'm all for knowing exactly what happened, and, if there's some... I have to tell you, though, after the incident, I was standing there after I realized someone was dead, and I was telling my husband, well, we have to do something, and I'm thinking, well, that's law enforcement. Who do I call? But I decided I would call the 911, the El Paso Police Department. And while I was calling the El Paso Police Department, the security guards on the bridge, there's a private security guard company that's hired by the Federal Protective Services. One of the guards came up to me and started screaming in my face to get off the bridge. And there was a lot of people on the bridge at that point, a lot of Mexican people returning back to Mexico. And most of them left. And I told the officer I wasn't leaving. I had to report this incident. This was very serious, and I had to report this. And I was on the phone with 911 for about 6 minutes, and the security guard kept trying to intimidate me to get off of the bridge and go into Mexico. And eventually, I think he realized that the call was being recorded because it's 911. And then a few minutes later, the Customs Border Patrol agents came up, about 20 of them, and surrounded me and told me I needed to get off the bridge. And I said, I'm making this 911 call, and after I'm finished with it, I'm going to decide whether I'm going back to Mexico or going back into Texas, to the United States. But I really felt there was an effort on their part to make sure that everybody that was witnessing the event was dispersed off the bridge.
Really? You mean, in other words, law enforcement might have decided, we have a whole bunch of eyewitnesses. I guess there were a number of people on the bridge, right?
There were dozens and dozens of
people.
There were
dozens and dozens. So that's mm-hmm. potentially dozens and dozens of eyewitnesses. And you're saying yeah. that the Border Patrol and the private security attempted to disperse the witnesses instead of taking their testimony?
They didn't attempt. They did. It started with the private security guards, and then the Customs Border Patrol in the blue uniform came up to the bridge, and it was very intimidating, I have to tell you, to have that many officers with weapons telling me that I needed to leave the bridge.
And so you were talking with 911 as these dozen or two dozen officers surrounded you?
Yes.
And did you continue your call with 911? What were you telling 911?
I'm trying to tell them what I've just seen, and at the same time, they're trying to distract me from my call and make me leave. So it was quite a predicament to try to maintain a 911 call while I'm being told by other officers that I need to leave the area. And like I said, the first officer was screaming inches from my face to get off the bridge and to leave.
Now, as I said, the FBI reported immediately after the incident that this may have been an alien smuggler, and they essentially repeated the Border Patrol story about their agents being surrounded by stone-throwing smugglers. They were in danger, and so they opened fire. Did the FBI contact you since to get your story?
Well, this is what happened when the El Paso Police Department did show up. It took at least an hour, I believe longer. They informed me, three patrol officers, or three cars of patrol officers, informed me that they had no jurisdiction, that I needed to contact the FBI. So I asked the officer for the FBI's number, and he got it for me, and I called the FBI, and they eventually came out and took my statement.
And they, and when was that? Was this a couple of hours after the shooting?
Yeah, I don't think I saw the FBI agent until 9:30, quarter to 10.
9:30, quarter to 10, and this happened at around a quarter to 7.
Exactly.
So about two and a half hours until you spoke with the FBI. But you did speak to them somewhere between 9:30 and 10 o'clock on Monday night.
Right, about 3 hours after the incident.
About 3 hours after the incident. Mm-hmm. And you told them exactly what you saw?
Yes, to the best of my ability and recollection.
And did they seem interested?
They were very professional. It was a man and a woman, and they took my statement. The woman wrote it down, and they were very pleasant, and I haven't heard a word since.
Were you surprised? I mean, my FBI quote came from the following day, in which they were still essentially regurgitating the Border Patrol agent's point of view. So they had already, by the next day, they already had your statement.
They did.
Do you know if they had other eyewitness accounts?
I do not.
Okay. Have you spoken to any of the other eyewitnesses?
I have not.
Okay.
I'm not sure who they were, because there's people going back and forth across the bridge all day long, and it's not like we all know one another. We're just people moving back and forth across the bridge.
I totally understand that.
Well, except for my husband, who was there as well. I mean, I have spoken with him.
And was he horrified?
He's pretty upset, I have to tell you. He's from Mexico. He's a Mexican national. And imagine if the Mexican police had fired over into our country and killed one of our citizens. We would be outraged. You know, I know that there's more than just the Border Patrol's version of what happened.
All right, Bobby McDowell, eyewitness to a terrible incident last Monday on that bridge that links Juarez to the United States at El Paso. A shooting underneath Border Patrol did kill a 14-year-old by shooting him in the head. And there's obviously a lot more to this story than we've heard so far. I want to thank you very much for spending this time, Bobby McDowell, and giving us your point of view, your experience, and your eyewitness account.
You're welcome.
In Berkeley, I'm Jesse Strauss, reporting for Flashpoints. As BP's Gulf Gusher continues to spew oil at up to 2.5 million gallons per day, we're continuing our coverage of that disaster. While the oil is destroying the Gulf Coast natural environment, killing thousands of animals between Louisiana and Florida, and massively disrupting local economies along these coasts, the effects of the gusher are overwhelming. New Orleans, of course, is still reeling from the effects of Hurricane Katrina. While the direct damage was then caused by a natural disaster, it has become clear that the effects of Katrina have had even more devastating impacts in New Orleans' poor communities and communities of color because of the lack of government support in the rebuilding process. As some construction efforts have supported those communities, BP's disaster, which is much less natural, has reawoken the fears of Louisiana residents. We are now joined by journalist and activist in Louisiana, Jordan Flaherty. Flaherty has been focusing his recent work on the impacts and effects of these destructive disruptions in New Orleans communities. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Jordan.
Thank you, Jesse. It's always a pleasure to be on Flashpoints, and I really appreciate all the work you all do to spread the word about these and other issues.
And we really appreciate the work you do. You've been covering these disasters for quite a while in New Orleans. In the face of Katrina, 5 years later now, how is this gusher of oil being felt physically on the ground there where you are in New Orleans?
You know, I spoke to Monique Hardin, the director of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, and she said, I never thought I'd be in a situation where I wanted another Katrina, but I'd rather Katrina than this. It feels apocalyptic, and it's become a cliche at this point to say a slow motion Katrina, but that's what it feels like. Every day it just keeps coming and coming, and the news gets worse and worse. At the very beginning, the BP and Transocean and federal government really tried to downplay it, and then we heard that it was more and more and more coming out, and then we heard more about the safety precautions that they didn't take, and then we heard about the underwater plumes. Then we heard about the dangers that the dispersants cause, and then so the news just keeps getting worse and worse with every day. And you know, I focused in my recent article on the communities down there in the bayous of the Gulf and the extinction that they're facing. But people are really panicked here in New Orleans too. Monique Hardin again talked about how she grew up here and then she went away for law school and she came back here for the oysters. And you know, that's just one person, but the seafood really defines our culture, and this idea that we won't have Gulf, you know, shrimp or oysters or other kinds of fish life for perhaps a generation is terrifying to people. That, you know, has shaped the food and in many ways the lifestyle of the city. And we are unfortunately a very tourist-based economy. And how does that affect our economy when that, you know, that famous Gulf Coast seafood no longer exists, and has that changed, you know, the cuisine the people come here for, the food the people come here for? Already restaurants across town are changing their menus, taking oysters off their menus. So it's, you know, it's a cultural transformation even for here in New Orleans, and much, much worse for the people on the Gulf who almost, you know, universally rely for their income and their livelihood on seafood.
We've talked a lot about the devastating impact of the oil in the Gulf's wildlife and the local economies in the past few months, but we haven't focused our reporting so much on the cultural effects of the disaster. In your article, one of the things you said was that at least 5 Louisiana towns, all majority African American, have been eradicated due to corporate pollution in recent decades. What do you see happening on a cultural level in New Orleans and in the region because of this Gulf gusher?
Well, I visited the folks from Pointe aux Chiens, which is an Indian tribe down south of Houma on the Gulf Coast. And I was prepared for, because I'd read news reports and heard from folks, I was prepared for, to some extent, what they were facing in terms of the fishing season being canceled, the loss of livelihood. And I knew some of the coastal loss that they faced down there. But really, being down there was a transformative experience for me, to see this beautiful, idyllic community that is just being destroyed by oil company greed. You have in that region, in the southern Louisiana, 10,000 miles of canals that have been dug by the oil companies that have brought salt water into these people's homes and communities and devastated their communities, their homes. The main street through Pointe aux Chiens, you walk along it, and there's a bayou on either side, and then it ends in water, and you can see that the road continues on, and there's telephone poles continuing on as if there were a road, but the road is covered in water. There's these husks of trees sticking out of the water that once were beautiful live oak trees. You know, it's just devastation. And they've, you know, we in the state of Louisiana are losing a football field of land every 45 minutes and have been for decades now. And about half of that is caused by directly by these oil companies, by these canals that they've dug. And if you go back, this tribe, Pointe aux Chiens, they've lived there for 300 years. And it was just in the early part of the 20th century that these oil companies basically took advantage of the fact that this tribe lived a separate culture from the rest of the state, and they spoke a different language, mostly French, and they were, you know, financially independent. They were culturally separate from the rest of the state. These oil companies took advantage of that and basically laid claim to their land. They basically bought their land at auction in New Orleans, and these auctions that the tribes didn't even know anything about. They bought the land out from under the feet of these tribes, basically stole their land, and then, you know, began a decades-long process of destroying the land with all this drilling and the canals that they dug. And it's just been destroying their homes. You know, they showed me a ancient burial ground of theirs that is just a little small patch of land surrounded by water. You can't get there otherwise than through a boat. And the oil companies had tried to dig directly through that burial ground. And this was decades ago. Some of the tribal elders went there with shotguns and chased the oil companies away. That was the only way they protected it. But still, the water is rushing towards it and nearly destroying it now. It's, you know, this BP drilling disaster is huge, but it's just the latest step in this process that's been going on for decades of just really destroying these people's lives and stealing the land out from under their feet.
That's the voice of Jordan Flaherty, a union activist, a journalist, and the editor of Left Turn magazine. He's speaking with us currently from New Orleans. Given the disaster right now, yesterday BP executives agreed to set up a $20 billion fund to give a little help to the Gulf residents for compensation for the oil disaster. And Obama's response to that, and this is a quote, is that this is about accountability. At the end of the day, that is what every American wants. Clearly, this fund is not going to be able to respond to all these issues that you're speaking of. So what's your take on Obama's speech on this fund? And do you have any suggestions or ideas about how some of these communities can be supported in the face of these disasters?
Well, first of all, I think the government should seize BP straight out. Second of all, I think that we really need to change the relationship that we have to these companies, especially here in Louisiana, where they've been walking all over us. But nationwide, you know, we've lost regulation just like we lost regulation on Wall Street and it destroyed the U.S. economy. We've destroyed all the regulation on these industries, and it's allowed them to destroy our environment and to also wreak havoc on our economy, and especially the economy of people like these fisher folk in the coastal regions. So we need to change our relationships to these companies fundamentally. And that's something that, again, Monique Hardin, who I spoke to with Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, spoke to as well, that she said we have to change the way that we allow businesses to be in charge of our health and safety. And, you know, she talked about places like Norway when they're digging a well, like the Deepwater well that blew out 2 months ago now. They, at the same time, dig a relief well, you know, that they have that in place. Right now, BP is, you know, basically in the beginning stages of this relief well that we don't even know if it'll work, but if it does work, it won't be for another 2 months. So there's, you know, even if we're accepting that this oil drilling has to happen, which I don't think we have to accept, but even if we accept that, there's basic minimum precautions that could have been taken that are not being taken, and we need to completely overhaul the regulations that we have and the oversight that we have of these companies. There needs to be a complete sea change in that. And it's not just the drilling, but it's also the chemical treatment companies. And, you know, you mentioned that in the article, I also talk about these African-American communities that were displaced by mostly oil treatment and other chemical companies.
Right.
So there have been 5 of these Louisiana towns, all of them founded by formerly enslaved folks, that have been completely eradicated due to corporate pollution. The most recent one is the town of Mossville, which was founded by African Americans in the 1790s. It's only 5 square miles, and in that 5 square mile area, the state of Louisiana allowed 14 companies to build their facilities there. And it reached a point where now 91% of residents have reported at least one health problem related to exposure to chemicals produced by the local industry. So you have entire towns, entire communities just, you know, made sick and then basically forced to move away as a result of this corporate pollution. The town of Diamond, which was founded by the descendants of the participants of the 1811 rebellion to end slavery. And for your listeners who might not know of that rebellion, that was the largest slave uprising in U.S. history. It was inspired by the Haitian Revolution, happened here in Louisiana, just upriver of New Orleans. The descendants of the participants of that uprising founded this town of Diamond, and the town was basically completely destroyed by Shell. Everyone who lived there was poisoned, and they sued Shell and were given some sort of payment to help them to move, and Shell basically got what they wanted all along, which was their land. The town was completely razed, and the only thing that's left is the graveyard. And if residents, former residents, want to visit their relatives' grave sites, they have to walk through company security, through the company gates, and there's the graveyard, kind of the only remnant of this town that's left in the middle of this giant, poisonous corporate facility.
And Jordan, we're running out of time. It's really important and great to hear these stories. Is this something, I mean, you're talking about the destruction of these communities by many different companies over decades and decades. Do you think we're going to see similar patterns in the face of this BP disaster? Is BP just going to end up moving people out, changing the geographies of these communities?
Well, they've certainly already changed, they and the other oil companies. This is not just about BP, but they and the other oil companies have already changed the geography of the state. If you look at a map of Louisiana, even of a few decades ago, there was so much more land down in the south of the state. So they've already changed our geography. Will they force these residents to move? I honestly can't see any other choice for a lot of these folks to move. And, you know, it's not just this Native American community that I spoke about. There's the African American community of Phoenix, Louisiana. There's Vietnamese American communities, other Native American communities besides the one I spoke of. There's working class white communities down there. All of these communities are in serious danger of losing their livelihood and culture. And they're all at a serious risk. And I think, you know, what listeners can do, I would advise, is look at some of these organizations that are working to help these communities, like Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, Gulf Restoration Network. But more than anything, we really need change on a federal level. We need more, at the very minimum, more regulation of these industries. And we really need a lot more than that, but that's a good start.
So we're out of time. That's the voice of Jordan Flaherty, an activist, journalist, and the editor of Left Turn magazine. He's speaking with us from New Orleans. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us, Jordan. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. And people can see some of the groundwork that communities have laid for this resistance in my new book that's coming out this month as well, Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6.
You're listening to Flashpoints, your daily investigative news magazine. First, WikiLeaks. United States military and national security agencies are clearly attempting to close in on WikiLeaks and close it down for good. In April, WikiLeaks released the collateral murder video showing U.S. soldiers in Iraq killing civilians and a Reuters photographer and then shooting at people, including children. Now WikiLeaks claims to have a secret military video of one of the deadliest U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan, which shows scores of children being killed. As we go to air, an Army intelligence analyst suspected of leaking classified information to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was arrested by the military. The soldier PFC Bradley Manning has still not been charged 3 weeks after being arrested and put into pretrial confinement. He is being held at Camp Arifjan in Kuwait and has been assigned a military defense attorney. Meanwhile, Iceland's parliament voted unanimously in favor of making the country a haven for freedom of expression by offering legal protection to whistleblowers' websites like WikiLeaks. Joining us to talk about this issue that goes to the core of the First Amendment and free speech is FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley. Rowley is a former FBI agent. She holds a law degree and served in Minneapolis as Chief Division Counsel, a position which included oversight of freedom of information as well as providing regular legal and ethics training to FBI agents. In 2002, Rowley brought some key information to the 9/11 investigation that we would have never known about. She brought it to light. It wasn't always greeted with a friendly smile. And she testified before Congress about the endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. She joins us from the Midwest. Colleen Rowley, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hi. I'm thinking when you recite that bio of me that I might need to add something like, I was maybe one of the only so-called whistleblowers to actually safely be able to get my retirement, not be fired, and actually to, because I got on the cover of Time magazine, it was kind of changed the whole way back in 2002 that whistleblowing was viewed. There was a short window there. There was a kind of a gleaming time when whistleblowing was seen as a good thing, And now, of course, it's kind of gone back the other way, where you have this large number of people that are treating Bradley Manning as a leaker, as something, as a traitor, you know, all these tattletale, snitch, all of these terrible things that they call you.
And the guy that turned him in is sort of turned into a hero by the same papers that benefited from the other example of important freedom of information releases, the Pentagon Papers. I want to talk to you about a number of different things. We're so glad to have you with us. But just begin with a brief thumbnail sketch of what you think made you a whistleblower. What was the information that the various intelligence agencies didn't want the people to know?
And, you know, we don't want to get into this too much because it is in the 9/11 Commission report. If people want to really know some of these, this information, Chapter 8 is called "The System Was Blinking Red." And that is a detail that actually is more than my memo, much, much more, because my memo led to a 2-year-long Inspector General investigation just of the FBI lapses. And I didn't even know about all the FBI lapses when I wrote the memo. So my memo led to an IG investigation, and essentially in the FBI, it was three parts. There were two of the suspected terrorists that come into California, and there's all kinds of things. They were staying with an FBI source, all kinds of things there. One of our agents wanted to launch a fugitive investigation for these two Al-Qaeda. They were on the CIA's terrorist list already, and he was told no. Then there was the Moussaoui case that was the case that I knew about here in Minnesota. And then there was a third memo out of Phoenix in the FBI that said was very urgent. It was an urgent warning to look at flight schools. And all three of these were, what turned out to be, verified as really bad lapses in the FBI. And then, of course, if you go to the 9/11 Commission, Chapter 8, the FBI's lapses are just a small, small part of the greater ones, the CIA and the FAA and et cetera, at every level. So if what happens when you have terrible problems and scandals happening is that I think it's not a deliberate conspiracy in government for everyone to be quiet and shut their mouth or, basically deliberately mislead the public about what has gone wrong. It's not deliberate, but everybody's interest, self-interest, leads to basically people keeping their mouth shut.
All right, let me also recommend that people read the piece WikiLeaks Cases Echoes Pentagon Papers that you wrote with Bob Perry for ConsortiumNews.com, a very important piece. Let me read just a little bit of a statement that you released today, Colleen Rowley, along with Daniel Ellsberg and former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. I just want people to get a taste of the stand that the three of you took today. Today, and this is your statement, today Washington is trying to shut down what it clearly regards as the most effective and dangerous purveyor of embarrassing information, WikiLeaks, a self-styled global resource for whistleblowers. It is a safe bet that NSA, CIA, FBI, and other agencies have been instructed to do all possible to make an example of WikiLeaks leader, Australian-born Julia Assange, and his colleagues. Much is at stake for both Pentagon and freedom of the press. Now, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about what exactly you see as being at stake. What's at stake? Why is a group like WikiLeaks crucial, a whistleblowing platform?
Well, of course, you're in the media, so you know what's going on here. We do have independent media who are doing a good job. There are Pacifica, and there are smaller media enterprises, but the larger, what we call mainstream media, and certainly the newspapers, New York Times and Washington Post, would come to mind immediately as being the pillars of the mainstream media, are not doing what they did 4 decades ago. And 4 decades ago, when Daniel Ellsberg had copied 7,000 pages of the Pentagon Papers, a study that, looked at, I think, 3 decades of foreign policy in Vietnam. When he had those papers, the New York Times bravely defied Nixon's court orders to publish that. And then when the court shut them down at the time, the Washington Post picked up the torch and went on, and finally 17 other newspapers. And you saw the press really doing what Edmund Burke, carved out and called them the fourth estate, and how they're necessary to democracy and a watchdog on the other three branches. So 4 decades ago, they got their courage and they did what they were supposed to. And I think this is the key thing that we're looking at now. We're at this moment where our mainstream media has gone in the other direction. Instead of having courage, courage is contagious, is what Julian Assange says, the founder of WikiLeaks. I think I've actually heard Daniel Ellsberg say that too, courage is contagious. But the opposite corollary to that is cowardice is contagious. And certainly when you see one newspaper basically transcribing press releases from the government, and if there was a 9/11, if there was a terrible BP oil spill, if there are civilian casualties, reckless civilian casualties in war, the government has every incentive to not tell the full truth about those things. And that's why we have a press. That's why we have a fourth estate. And unfortunately, I think this is what's so key right now, is they have a chance. If WikiLeaks is working on another video that shows, a really sad, tragic, horrible, killing of civilians that the Pentagon has really not even told the truth about, there's a good chance now for other media, more of our mainstream media, to pick up that torch. Unfortunately, when Julian Assange released that first video, the one he called Collateral Murder, where the shooting of the 12 men in the streets of Baghdad, including 2 Reuters journalists, I did not see the mainstream media pick that torch up and actually cover that very well. If they covered it at all, it was kind of to point to Julian Assange as some kind of a bad guy, and why is he making waves? Why is he making trouble this way?
Well, he is sort of underground, but he did surface on the internet to release what you refer to, to let us know that they will release. They're saying that they have another video which shows
right.
a terrible massacre after an airstrike in Afghanistan. They're saying scores of children were killed. Now, we don't have that yet, but we know that the last video was clearly revelatory in terms of what's been happening in some regard on the ground in Iraq. Now, as you say, Assange is these days has to go into hiding in order to keep doing this work. What is your concern if the Pentagon, if these intelligence agencies have their way and WikiLeaks is shut down?
Well, that's the worst scenario, absolutely. What I just mentioned about cowardice
yes.
Being contagious, I mean, that will absolutely push that, because the arrest alone of the 22-year-old Bradley Manning is an attempt by the Pentagon, and this we know, because this was also in a paper that was also leaked. And the paper actually says there is 2 or 3 ways to lessen the integrity. They're trying to do this through kind of a special op way of making people believe that that WikiLeaks is distorting, etc. So they have different ways, and they're definitely trying to intimidate anybody who would obviously be a whistleblower.
And the soldier, I mean, this is what, and this is from the piece that you did with Robert Perry. The soldier, according to the Washington Post, is depicted Manning as a troubled soldier,
right.
slight of build,
right.
a loser
right.
who had just gone through a breakup, who, and these are quotes,
right.
who had been, quote, demoted a rank in the Army after striking a fellow soldier. The Times gets worse, and then it praises Lamo, it praises mm-hmm. the snitch who turned him in, who is trying to sort of paint himself as a hero trying to protect national security. Do you think that the snitch was doing his job protecting national security?
Well, I will use Daniel Ellsberg's line because he knows more about this than I do, and I know a lot. He said about 1% of all classified documents need to be classified. I actually worked in FBI's, you know, secret sources and informants and stuff, and I don't know exactly what percent needs to be classified. There are some things that need to be classified. Most can be classified temporarily, not in perpetuity. So something that our government did 40 years ago under JFK or whatever, you know, that comes a time when that even very sensitive things at the time can then be released. When you're working in criminal cases, if you are monitoring a mafia guy, of course that has to be secret for the time period of the investigation. It certainly doesn't have to remain secret for 5 years or 10 years or something like that. So what happens, though, and why Daniel Ellsberg says 1% is classifiable, is that government uses that ability, that ability to stamp secret on things, to also cover up guilty knowledge of incidents. They use it to cover up just embarrassing things. You know, collateral murder is certainly a mistake. They shot children and everything else, and they don't want people to know about that. Let me ask you a question. That first story you just reported, you mentioned that 4 or 5 soldiers in Afghanistan are indicted for premeditated murder. And what struck me when you reported that is, guess what? We don't even know. The public doesn't know what those 4 or 5 soldiers did. Was it something like the Haditha case where they shot 3 families, including babies? Is it something like the guy who raped and murdered the 14-year-old girl in Iraq? You know, the public doesn't even know. And here, the soldiers who are sent abroad, of course, to fight for the United States and in Americans' names, and we don't even know what's going on. How can we exercise an informed vote? How can we even communicate effectively or in an informed way with our elected leaders when we're being kept in the dark about these things?
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley, and she's written a piece that appears in the consortiumnews.com. Just, I guess it came out yesterday, WikiLeaks case echoes Pentagon Papers, an important piece, and this battle over WikiLeaks and a platform, a place for whistleblowers in various agencies to really express that notion of information as a human right. Do you see it that way, information as a human right?
Well, our whole system of governance and preventing corruption requires inside information. If you were to ask an FBI agent, do they need whistleblowers? They're not going to equivocate. Almost every good case in the FBI, whether it's a corporate, whether it's a Ponzi scheme, whether it's a corporate fraud, whether it's public corruption, requires that some insider come walk into the FBI. We just had this happen with a $10 million Ponzi scheme in Minnesota that had gone for 10, 15 years. And, of course, no one's going to know about this. I can't remember if it was a secretary, but it was some person who worked in the office who says, I'm going to go tell the FBI about it. That's a whistleblower. That's a corporate whistleblower, but it's a whistleblower. And it's the way justice occurs. It's just absolutely integral to have open disclosures of fraud, waste, abuse, illegality, or a public safety risk. And you won't find, here's the irony here. If you go into Congress, you will not find a congressperson who can argue against protection for government whistleblowers. In fact, there's been at least 3 or 4 years now, they voted unanimously for protection for government whistleblowers. How could they argue that we don't want to know about government fraud? If someone's overcharging the Pentagon, we don't, you know, I'm in Congress, I'm on the Arms Services Committee, but I'm going to put my head in the sand. I don't want anyone to tell me if Halliburton is cheating the government. I mean, it's impossible to argue that you don't want truthful disclosures of this type of important information. But the problem is the people in Congress also stop the government protection of whistleblowers. It gets into the Senate. This has been going on for now 5 to 10 years, and a secret hold is put on in the Senate. There's currently a secret hold on reform that would actually protect government whistleblowers. And so how does that happen? Well, the people in power are very afraid that if they actually protect these types of disclosures internally, now I'm not talking about going to the press, I'm talking about internally, like going to your inspector general, or perhaps, as Daniel Ellsberg tried to do, warning Congress, who's the separate and equal branch. There's no protection now if you're an FBI agent. You can't even go communicate with your own congressperson and tell them, let's say the FBI, is spending too much, or that's a bad case, the computer fraud, but I'm going to mention, let's say that there's a Russian spy in the FBI. Of course, that was a true case, and you know about it, and so far you've been ignored. You can't even go talk to your congressperson and tell them about that as the law exists right now. It's incredible.
You're listening to Flashpoints. Now, I'm thinking of this comment by this sort of craftsman who fled the Nazis in Italy and ended up with them in Argentina, and he used to say these amazing things, and one of the things that he said is truth has very few friends, and those few are suicides. Now that's a troubling thought. Or do you commit suicide in your political life, in your personal life, in your professional life by telling the truth?
Well, I'll suggest a couple of movies. One is The Tobacco Insider, the story of Jeffrey Wigand. And, of course, he lost his job, he lost his family, and actually his life was even threatened. Now, the good ending of the Tobacco Insider, Jeffrey Wigand, is eventually, and it takes a lot, he finally makes it onto 60 Minutes. And guess what? It makes a huge difference. The laws start to change. The lawsuits finally are won against big tobacco. So even he prevailed. It took him a long time, and it was extremely devastating. I wouldn't say suicide is probably not exactly. Certainly, I want to encourage. I don't want to tell people that it's suicide to try to.
But
tell
that
the
would
truth.
Be the mesh. That would be the message if they shut down WikiLeaks and put this soldier in jail, right?
Well, you know what? There's a possibility. It's going to be hard. Even if they were to get a hold of Assange, he's not WikiLeaks. He's the founder of it. He's the public face. But the way I understand it is there are many other people out there. Iceland, part of the story is that Iceland has now passed a law that will make it more safe for whistleblowers, in basically kind of a haven for whistleblowing and freedom of the press. So we have to hope that, like I said, other media will finally see which side they should be on. If they take the side of the, instead of speaking truth to power, they take the side of power and they vilify whistleblowers and they say, what's happening now with calling Bradley Manning, lame and all these things that they called him. If they take that side, they have to see that their future is, first of all, they're selling their soul from what Edmund Burke and the founding fathers imagined our freedom of press to be. That's part of it. But also, they are going to go down the same way. There's that Niemöller thing. First they came for so-and-so, then they came for the gypsies, and then they came for the Jews, and then they came for me. And I think...
And there was nobody there to hear, right?
I think the media needs to see that if the powers really now stop and attack this new form of free press that's using higher tech methods, that they are vested there too. And that means that the government can tell them exactly what to write and do. It means that power will exist.
I want to come back to what one of the co-writers of the statement with you and Daniel Ellsberg says, Ray McGovern. He refers to the corporate media as the fawning corporate media or the FCM. Now, in your statement, you all write, and I do want you to comment on this, those who own and operate the corporate media face a distasteful dilemma, both in terms of business decision and of conscience. They must choose between the easier but soulless task of transcribing government press releases on the one hand, or on the other, following WikiLeaks into the 21st century by adapting high-tech methods to protect sources while acquiring authentic stories unadulterated by government pressure, real or perceived. How important is this?
It's extremely important right now when we have a New York Times Pulitzer Prize winning writer who himself is threatened to be jailed. He's been subpoenaed to reveal his sources on a book that revealed warrantless monitoring, completely illegal warrantless monitoring that Bush had begun. And also there's levels of this illegality, because there's also a corruption part of it where contractors had different programs. So that man, there's more than one source for this, by the way, but one of the sources for that story that we know of right now is also charged. So he's being prosecuted.
And the journalist?
The journalist is James Risen.
Right.
And he's been subpoenaed to reveal his sources. One of the sources for the story, not Risen's source, but he was a source for the Baltimore Sun's, I think it was Baltimore Sun's, series of stories on corruption involved in the NSA monitoring.
One of the few papers left. People don't know much about it, but it does an incredible job where the Post falls short.
Yep. And so we need the media to kind of see themselves in the place of Mike Wallace. And even if they make a mistake at one point, and so you say, no, we're not going to be on the sides of the cover-up and on the sides of the powers. The powers use the media to plant stories like Judith Miller did. You know, we're not
and you know, this is what we say, Colleen Rowley. This is what I believe. This is what we believe at the Flashpoint Show, that it's our job, as Amira Huss says, incredible report of Haaretz, it's our job to monitor the centers of power, whether they're in the government, the corporations, local politicians, whatever it is. That's our job as the fourth estate, and to report to the people. We only have a minute left, but what do you think the Congress should and do and could do now to change history and protect the open flow of information?
Well, they need to pass laws that protect, to some extent, I mean, they can differentiate, but they need to pass good protection for sources, for reporters. They also need to pass protection for government employees who are put into this terrible position of witnessing fraud, waste, abuse, illegality, or a public safety risk, and need to have a safe way to reveal that to someone who can stop, can fix the problem.
Amazing. Well, I want to thank you so much for all your public service, Colleen Rowley, as a FBI whistleblower. I don't always agree with Time's Person of the Year, but I am glad they picked you in 2002, because it did give you the protection and the cover. One, to be able to get your, as you say, to get your retirement intact, while others have not been. And they did recognize a very significant and courageous woman. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that wraps it up for another edition of The Best of Flashpoints, which was produced by Jesse Strauss. Thank you for listening.